Blackwater, The Wagner Group, Executive Outcomes, The Flying Tigers, The Swiss Guard, The White Company, The Knights Templar, The Varangian Guard, Clercus of Sparta, Pythagoras the Spartan, Mentor of Rhodes, Socrates of Achaea. The list is endless. Mercenaries, guns for hire, soldiers of fortune, private military companies, private security contractors, dirty deeds done not so dirt cheap. History is replete with privatized militaries. Call them what you want. They have been around for a very long time, and they are very likely not going away anytime soon. And like it or not, wars are good, very good, for business. Furthermore, history tells us that more people are enslaved and killed by such means as greed, corruption, oppression, and tyranny than by any other means. So choose the red pill, remove your blinders, all of them, and take a good sensory inventory of what you're being told and shown to believe. Because here we go. Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Oconus, The Contractor's Life. Talking from the relatively insulated and bucolic rural foothills of northwestern Washington State, I'm your host, Scott Dresser. Life as a private security contractor in a hostile or a war-torn zone, or, as some call it, an austere or a non-permissive environment. Well, it is a mixed bag of blessings. Some good and some not so good. All in all, though, private security contracting is much the same as life. It is what you make it. The MENA region, or the Middle East North Africa region. Lands of enchantment, lands of mystery, lands of the old ones and the ancient ones. Myths, legends, folklore, maybe. If you believe what you read in the ancient and the holy texts, then you know that it all centered around what we refer to as the MENA region. That's right, the Mediterranean. And you probably also know that to every legend or myth, there is a base of at least some truth.
Hello everyone, welcome to the 8th episode of Season 4 of Oconus, The Contractor's Life. Picking up where we left off in the previous episode, somewhere around week 3, certainly somewhere between weeks 2 and 4. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of changes. Seems like every day there was something. You know, in a lot of projects, there's a lot of wash, rinse, repeat elements to it. And what I mean by that is, you know, you kind of get used to the routine. It becomes ingrained. Depending on the complexities, it might take a few days, could take a few weeks to really get it down and be an old hat at it. But, you know, for the most part, certainly within the end of the first month of any new project, you become an old hat at it. So that's kind of where we're at. We kind of got this stuff figured out and sorted out. On this particular project, because of the project manager that we had and one specific particular client representative, between the two, a peculiar set of failures began to rear their ugly head. It's not like the other guys didn't notice or recognize what was going on. But they recognized to a large extent what I recognized in terms of failures of leadership there on the ground with our project manager there. And I've already talked about that person and how I came to know him, along with another fellow when we flew in. So you just go back to a few episodes or somewhere in this season anyway. And I hearkened on it in previous seasons as well. But when you've got somebody, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there, both in editorial, both in books, in audio, and I'm sure some of you have probably heard lectures about it on traits of leadership. And there's people out there that, you know, pretend to know all about it and think they're experts in that area. Probably the only people that are truly experts in those areas are people who've been around enough failures in leadership and have witnessed it firsthand on a great many occasions over a course of years. Likewise, similarly, perhaps the person in a leadership position who recognizes the successes of what they've from their leadership to everybody else. And, you know, a good leader obviously needs to really pay attention. And as a leader, in my opinion, at least based on some of my experiences, you should be at some point, to some extent, a little nervous or anxious about some of your decisions and some of your calls, because sometimes you just don't know for sure. And what worked previously in another situation, in another scenario, on a different project, it may work, it may not work at all. It may work, but not as well as it did previously. So, you know, part of the leadership thing, whether you're a parent or you're somebody that's part of the team, or your, you know, supervisor, manager, executive, whatever, is recognizing, paying attention. You've really got to pay attention to what's going on all around you, and not just the people who are at your same level or very close to your level, but, you know, all the other entities that comprise that project that you're a part of. You really need to hear and see what's going on. And if you're fortunate enough, maybe you can do that on a daily basis. At the very least, maybe you have one or two or three, maybe more, very trusted associates that can go out and do that for you. And at the end of the day, give you a recap of what they saw and heard and give you some sort of an analysis on it so that you can make the proper decision. So with that said, I mean, we had a failure of leadership at least three times on this project, as it continued to go on. But the first one, you know, some guys would say was the worst. It wasn't necessarily the worst, but it was certainly, you know, each of the three managers we had that came in succession had their own version of failure of leadership. The one common thread that they all had were a couple or a few things. One, they rarely showed up on the ground where we were at, rarely actively participated or engaged with us or with the client reps or the other people that were part of their organization to get a hands-on feel of what was really happening and what needed to be done and what didn't need to be done. Another thing is they didn't really readily make themselves available to such honest discourse. There was one fellow, he was the last fellow, and I don't want to get too far ahead of this, but he did at least show some signs of being able to at least have honest discourse, as long as you weren't just yammering and complaining, as long as, you know, you were calm, cool, and collected, and you were just giving them feedback and trying to come up with solutions. So if you had something in mind, you thought it over and presented him a solution, at least he was willing. But with that said, so, you know, it was the hands-off approach. It was the, hey, I'm the manager. You know, I can't be bothered with this sort of thing. I've got to be this and that and one thing and another. You know, so there is, depending on how big or large your organization is, there is a point at which, you know, they can't be bothered by it on a daily basis. But I've seen plenty of my share of examples where leadership did, you know, when it got to a certain volume or a certain tone, did avail themselves to get out there and see what was going on and go back and brood over it and figure out a solution to fix this. We didn't really see that with any of these three guys. So this first dude, I mean, it just got worse and worse and worse. It got to the point, actually with all three of them, where one or more of the top client reps, you know, would actually confide in me a little bit, you know, and try to figure out how can we get this guy out here, you know. And the biggest challenge we had And we never really got any really good answers from HQ there in country, was why can't we get more guys out here? So I don't know if the client entity just didn't want to pay more for extra guys, or if the company at our end just was not able to recruit the kinds of people that they needed for this project. You know, who knows what the actual bottom line issues were in terms of not being able to get the equipment and the personnel that we actually needed, that we asked for, to do our jobs 100% efficiently. Now, I know that some of you are probably thinking or saying to yourselves, well, that's kind of a luxury in a conflict zone. Call it a combat zone, call it whatever you want. But when you're in a conflict zone, when you're in an area of high threat, doing high threat, high risk work, especially when there's military units out there, it can be a luxury. There rarely is 100% efficiency. And there's a lot of reasons, to go into why that happens. So, I mean, it's understandable that you're not going to always get 100% of everything that you need or want. And you've got to be creative, you've got to be adaptable, and you just got to make it work. I get that. But the primary thing was a failure of leadership. We just had it all around. Being quite dismissive, being very argumentative, and constantly, puffing the chest and thumping it and selling the resume. It's like, dude, I'd like to see your resume and see if it matches your words, because your words are not selling us. Okay. And I think I did hearken, and I'll go in, I don't want to get too far ahead of it, but, you know, I did look into the guy quite a bit, fairly extensively at one point, and that ultimately led to his demise. But, you know, where I'm at is that we're on the ground, we're doing the work, we're out there in the heat, the sun, toiling away, and of course, as, you know, as the seasons advanced, you know, we got into the cold stuff. And for anybody that's been to Afghanistan, you probably already know that when you get beyond that central area and you start moving north, and the further north you go, especially if you're in the hills and the mountains area, it get pretty darn cold in the winter. And of course, in the summertime, it can get pretty warm. Some would say hot. And of course, you know, the further south you go, the hotter it gets. You're probably not going to notice it on an hour-to-hour change. So there we are, we're on the ground, and just this just seemingly insurmountable failure of leadership that's constant and consistent every day. For whatever reason, I'm sure it was a money thing, and I'll go into that here in a moment. For example, the location we were working, we had assigned to us only one vehicle. And the manager, kind of because he had to, because it was kind of, you know, the guys at HQ kind of put it out there. These guys need the vehicle to get to work and back. And the problem was, when we weren't using it, he had it. Going off, running around, doing whatever he was doing, filling his day with who knows. Because every time I went to visit him, he was always in his office, always staring at his computer screen. So, you know, there were plenty of times we didn't have the vehicle when we needed it or wanted it when we weren't working. And it turns out that at that time, one of the reasons we didn't have the vehicle, now I've worked for companies that made it so that you had whatever vehicles you need. They may not have been the choice luxury vehicles you wanted, but you had a vehicle that did the work, that did the job that you needed it to do, in whatever numbers you needed it. On this particular project, we didn't have that. We were told we were going to get it. We did finally get a second vehicle. I don't remember how many months into it. It was kind of a ragtag vehicle. I forget what it was. But it was a Russian make. It was kind of their version of a Jeep, if you will. It worked. It was manual transmission, not a big deal. It didn't have all the creature comforts of home, but it worked. It did the job. So, you know, that was settled. So we finally had two vehicles. There was enough for everybody to do what they needed to do. Of course, eventually, if there's going to be a problem, it's going to be a problem. And, you know, these guys, like I said before, not all of them, but a lot of them were more interested in taking the vehicle and going around the base and mingling and partying and doing whatever they were doing, rather than making sure that the vehicles were available for guys who needed it to get to work and back, go to the chow hall, maybe go to the gym, those sorts of things. Because there were those of us who were focused on the job. And when we weren't working, the only things we really wanted to do was go to the gym and or go to the DFAC, maybe anywhere between once a week and once a month, go get our haircut. Fortunately, where we were based in terms of our camp, our encampment, it was all that was within a reasonable walking distance. And at some point, I finally said, you know what, I'm just going to walk. Yeah, I did kind of disconnect from these guys. I kind of got away from them. They were just a source of irritants, constantly complaining about stuff and being distracted by anything and everything you could possibly think of in that kind of an environment. And in my opinion, it was, we were far from a well-oiled machine. So whatever they were doing and talking about, because there was a plenty of schmoozing on their part with the client, and engaging in stuff with, other client reps, if you will, to the extent that they were part of the client organization, fraternizing on a level that I thought was inappropriate. So we had all these things going on while we were still trying to do our jobs on a daily basis. And, you know, there's guys that like day shift. There's guys that like night shift. And there's other guys that, you know, whatever, day, night, whatever. Just give me a transition day or two between them when I've got to do that. So most of the guys wanted to work day shift. I kind of get that. But by the same token, it's like, well, problem is, when it's daytime for us back home, it's nighttime for the family. When it's nighttime for us back home, it's daytime for them. So if we worked an opposite shift, in other words, I worked the night shift, for example, which I learned to actually appreciate and enjoy, there was a lot fewer distractions. But the family was awake when I called, and they could call me, and I was awake. I was at work. But so I'm just saying, so there's pros and cons to everything. And so you become flexible, you adapt, you overcome, you make it all work. So, to not get ahead of myself, we did have these insurmountable failures of leadership on the ground that was taking a toll on some of these guys emotionally, and they were starting to act out, and it was causing sometimes problems on the job site, which we know is not a good thing. So with that said, I'm going to put a wrap on this episode. I apologize if it seemed a little herky-jerky. In the next episode, I'll try to consolidate a little bit more and go into detail about some of this stuff and try to keep that clarity going and keep it all synchronized. So with that said, I want to thank everyone, for taking time out of your day, afternoon, or evening to listen to me talk about private security contracting overseas during my tenure with Blue Hackle over there in Afghanistan, as well as sometimes my experiences as a private security contractor here in the States. Thank you to my wife, for whom I owe immeasurable gratitude, and that is true. Thank you to my family, my friends, and all the people, male and female, who have been and still are a part of my life. Remember, folks, it takes a team. The grass is not always greener on the other side. Be careful what you wish for, because you might just get it. Stay safe. Stay humble. Keep others safe by being aware and staying frosty. And until next time, keep it real.
Okonis the Contractor's Life extends a special thank you to music composer Kava Cohen and to Colin Perry of Ninja Tracks, for allowing Okonis the Contractor's Life the use of Kava's song, Heavy Clutch, from the music soundtrack to the game Forza Motorsport 7. And also, a big thank you to Andres Rodriguez, who can be found at the Fiverr website, for his excellent original music scores.